We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Good morning, Grinders. Welcome to Roto Grinders today. I'm Jordan Cooper, aka Blender Ed, Blender HD. You're gonna follow me on Twitter. And it's Monday, April 1st. It's April Fool's Day. So bring in the two biggest fools that there are in daily fantasy props and pick 'em. It's me. It's Jordan Cooper. Joined by it's Monday, so obviously got James McCool here and co-author with me on the theory of daily fantasy sports. You can pick that up right here. 15-hour audio DFS masterclass, as well as the advanced player's guide with my custom Excel tools. If you want to learn the game theory of DFS, if you want to have tools that James has developed that I use regularly to play DFS, like MLB DFS, I do use them. So pick that up at theoryofdfs.com. James, I've two topics today. What the first one, just for a recap over the weekend, I know you're a big proponent, James, of robot umps, right?
I am. Yeah.
Right. Sick and tired of the human biases in the strike zone, especially. I'm starting to think that in MMA, they need to be robot refs.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, I heard that there was a really bad decision.
Dude, the main card on Saturday, first off, the slate, halfway through the slate, one of the fights got canceled. So obviously, late scratch after, but fortunately enough, it was a female fight that I was way under. It wasn't the most owned fight. Obviously, sure. People that had Melissa Gatto in a lot of their lineups, probably get pissed off, but I didn't. So, it's whatever. A lot of times we get these scratches and it's like the highest owned fight on the entire slate and everyone goes nuts. Mm-hmm. This time, not so much. But then we had questionable, like three fights in a row. The first one, I'm fine with. The first one, Bill Algeo got knocked out on his feet by Kyle Nelson, kind of wobbled around and then tried to recover himself. And it looked like he was backing up in order to counter punch, but he was still on.
Yeah,
his equilibrium was whatever. He got hit with a clean shot, didn't go down, and the referee just basically stepped in and said it's over. Even though Algeo was I'm fine. But in those cases, I'm fine with earlier stoppage to protect the fighters if they're taking totally clean shots in the face. I get it. All right. Didn't mind the fact that I had a lot of Bill Algeo. So a little Come on, yeah. Really? But then we had two fights, James, that why even bother having rules? It's like, it's not only what happened in the both fights, that the rule was done differently in both. It's like you have the same rule and it's applied one way in the one fight, and then the very next fight, it's applied in a completely different way. And you wonder, what are people doing here?
Right.
So James, this is what happened in the Ruzaboev Dumas fight. There was an eye poke that the ref didn't catch.
Okay.
So essentially, in the first round, towards the end of the first round, Dumas got hit. You know, obviously they put their fingers out a little because they're grabbing. He got hit in the eye, reacted like squinted a bit. The ref didn't stop it. Mm-hmm. And in the process of him like going like he put his hands down and then just got knocked out because, you know, he got knocked down to the ground and finished on the ground. TKO. The replay showed that it was clearly an eye poke.
Yeah.
But they didn't review it. It was officially announced as a round one TKO. And it's like, what can you do? Even the commentators are like, well, what if the ref didn't see it, then it didn't happen. Even though there is a replay, there are replay officials
right
there. So they just basically put their arms up and said, well, if the ref didn't stop it, then oh well, feel free to appeal it afterwards. But the official result is that. That's the first thing, James. In the very next fight.
Yeah.
Literally in the next fight. There was an eye poke in the first round by Chris Weidman. Yeah. That the first accidental, right? So he gets kind of warned, right? Keep your fingers in. Then in the third round, Chris Weidman went in close and he poked Bruno Silva in the eye twice. Like literally put out his fingers, poked him in the eye, and then went to punch. And poked him in the right. And on the third punch, he kind of grazed the top of his head.
Yeah.
And Bruno Silva went down. And you could see on the replay that Bruno Silva didn't really go down due to that punch. He went down because he got poked in the eye twice.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, of course, he goes down to the ground and Chris Weidman follows him down to the ground. Silva covers up because he got poked in the eye twice and the ref stops it. So Chris Weidman is round three, TKO. They go to the review. It clearly shows that Weidman poked him in the eye twice.
Yeah.
It should be a point at least, if not a disqualification, because he was already warned in the first round. It was announced as a round three TKO, which is consistent with the last fight of like, oh, well, Ralph ref didn't see it, whatever. Mm-hmm. They overturned it to make it a technical decision. So basically it's the equivalent of another eye poke.
Yeah.
And Bruno Silva couldn't continue in round three. Hence it goes to the scorecards. Weidman won the first two rounds and Weidman wins a technical decision.
Okay.
Why can't we have like what? It's not only robot refs, James. It's robot like rule book. Like,
it's just you know when we have things like this, it kind of we see it in the NFL too, right? Where it's like the refs get something wrong, and it drastically changes the way the game finishes. We see it especially in the playoffs because, like, it's so teed in the playoffs. Like that infamous New Orleans non-PI that was called, where it's like the dude literally got laid out while trying to catch the ball. The defender didn't even look at the ball. He just tackled the dude. The ball wasn't even there yet. And the refs are just like, clean play. It's like, how can you possibly call that? And then how do we possibly not have systems that can correct it? Because that's the big.
Yeah, but even with the systems, James, the problem with me is
that the system wasn't used correctly in both.
Well, that's the point. I'm fine. Yeah. Remember, I grew up. I was an umpire, yeah. Right? I was an umpire. We didn't have replay. It's high school baseball. It's like there's no. You just go by. It's human biases. You try to get all the calls right. You're not going to get them all, and everyone accepts that. We now have, we have, in major sports, professional sports, we have instances. I mean, I saw over the weekend, there was some tag play. I forgot what game, but I saw the replay. Because anytime anyone complains about baseball umpires on Twitter and I see it, and I get, I'll go and check. To be fair, 90% of the time, the umpire was actually right, especially if it's a procedural thing, because if there's anything I know more, it's the Major League Baseball rule book. There was a tag play at third base. I don't know if you saw that on Twitter, because people were complaining about this. Like, why even bother having replay? I'm fine if you don't want to have replay. And just like, he was called out, and so be it. And that's bang, bang, he's out, even though he was safe. He gets challenged. It gets challenged. You can see clearly on the replay that the guy is safe, that the tag was applied high on the thigh, easily a half a second after the foot touched the base. Replay is done, and the call is upheld. Out.
Yep.
And then you just go, why even bother? Why, like, what? And I'm looking at this from an objective standpoint of like, I have no care in the world. I want to get the calls right. Like that's what I learned when I was trained to be an umpire. I said the number one priority is to get the call right. Like in the instance of, well, I don't want to slow down the game. I don't want to ask my partner. It's like, no, take 5 minutes and make sure the calls are right.
Right.
Right. Make sure the rules are followed. Right. Like stuff like that. And if you're going to take 3 to 4 minutes on a replay review and then still get it wrong. Like we might as well just not have replay. I mean,
we might as well have bigger penalties for umpires and refs to get it wrong again. Like the umpire in the NFL, I have less vitriol towards NFL refs because those dudes are not even contracted employees of the NFL. That's a second part-time job for these guys, which, by the way, is asinine that the NFL, this multi-billion dollar organization that could for sure hire full-time refs, doesn't, and could for sure have better technology than a chain gang to spot the ball, but doesn't. That's a whole other thing. But, like, I have a little bit...
And do you realize also, James, do you realize that the chain gang... are volunteers?
Yeah, literally volunteers. Literally volunteers. Just no excuses for these things. That said, I have a little bit more leniency for the NFL where they have basically like dudes who are just out there doing their best, you know, rather than in the MLB where there is a full-out umpires union, which is the reason why these guys aren't punished more heavily. That needs to change. Like, I'm fine. You want to unionize? That's fine. But you should still be reprimanded for doing things incorrectly. You fall below a certain baseline standard in, like, reviews. Because that's a very human thing, right? Like, I'm fine with keeping that human. You want to keep that human? Do your thing. But there needs to be punishments. There needs to be fines. There needs to be suspensions, whatever. I don't know. Something for the human element. As far as the calling balls and strikes things, zero reason why we should not introduce a robot umpire as a check and balance behind the umpire. You want to keep the umpire behind the plate and have them hit their 96% of calls or whatever? Fine. But if you have a pitcher like Max Fried who has bases loaded, it's a 2-2 count, there's two outs, and he throws that right down the dick and the umpire misses it and it leads to runs, like, can't have that. There needs to be a robot behind that umpire who, in that high leverage situation, we can defer to that, and teams can challenge a ref's call of ball or strike, because that we just don't have any.
As someone that comes from an officiating background in baseball, I when people ask me about robot strike zone, I am 100,000,000% for a robot strike zone, only because, and before all the technology, I typically stick up for the umpires, because calling balls and strikes at a major league level is the hardest job in all of sports officiating. If you have never, it looks it to you at home, it looks so simple, right? You sit, but you miss it a lot of times. You know, when they do show the trajectory, you go, okay, that was just outside, or that was just in the zone, or whatever. When you're behind the plate, seeing 92 mile an hour sliders and 83 mile an hour, you know, 12 to 6 curveballs, like it is immensely, like, it is a skill that you develop over years upon years. When you're doing a 9-10 year old, you know, baseball, when they're throwing, you know, 40 miles an hour, pretty easy, right?
Yeah.
When you're doing high school baseball, when they're throwing 80-90 miles an hour and not all that well, college baseball, like, there are pitches that look like they're going directly down the middle and then tail off 6 inches off the plate, and vice versa. It's extremely hard to do. So I for them to have a 98% accuracy rate on balls and strikes is incredibly impressive. Yeah. If a layperson, James, if you went and did that on Major League Baseball, I'd gather that you wouldn't even get a 3/4 of the calls correctly.
Like, no, no,
like, you'd miss every fourth pitch, you'd get wrong. But to me, that's the argument for making it robot. In tennis, you know, all these faults are now called by the eye, right? Because especially in men's tennis, when the serves are 140 miles an hour, getting that little, you know, it used to be that you challenge it and you'd look up, especially in clay courts, you'd see the mark of the ball.
Yeah.
But now they just let the eagle eye or whatever. Basically, they just call all of those. I mean, tennis essentially is almost all called via you know, radar, essentially. Yeah. And I don't see why they can't, other than traditionalists and obviously the umpires union. I mean, to me, balls and strikes are the easiest thing to just give to technology and move on. In the same way that James, the spotting the ball in an NFL game should be that also.
Yeah, it 100% should be. I mean, we have, and some people will say, like, for the NFL argument, we'll say, oh, well, the ball is too big. So, like, tracking technology, it's harder with a ball that big. Because, like, in tennis, they have, like, the way that they do it, they have the chip in the ball, right? Like, each ball has a chip in it. So having a chip in a football is, like, people argue that, like, the size causes fluctuations or something. What? I don't know.
Whoa, James, are you kidding me? Dude, if you could tell me that the spot of the ball in NFL will be at worst the length of the ball, that's better than some of the spots that I see on a regular basis in NFL.
Hold on. Let me get back to what I was saying, though. Because in soccer, they can spot that thing to a millimeter on the pitch. So and a soccer ball is bigger than a football. Don't tell me that the size of the football is the reason why we're not using this technology. It's not. It's just because NFL doesn't want to give up, I don't know, however many hundreds of thousands of dollars it would take to implement the technology, which is asinine. And most of it just does come back to purists, like you said. In baseball, it's literally just the umpires union and old people who are against technology. That's it. I also want to say the technology is not perfect here. Like the technology that they're using for baseball, this Hawkeye stuff, it's not perfect. They do use it in the minors, and it does cause some issues. Like the strike zone as an automated strike zone can have some hiccups, and the way that the tracking technology is used can have some little quirks here and there based on like edges and corners and stuff like that, right? But it doesn't even need to be perfect right now if we just use it for high leverage situations behind an umpire. And if we never get rid of the umpires, fine. Angel Hernandez can pitch until he has rolled over in his grave three times. Like he has, and going back to your point, he has like a 93% success rate, and that's still ridiculously good.
He shouldn't be. I mean, come on.
No, he shouldn't be. He should not be an umpire. But he is, because the umpires union. So if they want to keep Angel Hernandez back there, fine, whatever. But don't allow him to control the high leverage situations. That should be offloaded onto laser technology, because we have it. Like, there's no reason not to use it. We have it.
Mr. Gerg makes a point about UFC. Why do they bother having point deductions if all the referees do is warn the fighters when they have? Yeah, I agree. I agree with all. Greg Ehrenberg tweeted, I think yesterday, about this, basically. I think if I was a smart fighter, and most fighters are not smart, if they were smart, they wouldn't be fighting. That's typically what I say. Like, why didn't the fighter do the thing that would have been the smart move? It's like these guys joined and said, you know what, I want to get punched in the face for a living for not as enough pay that I should be getting in the top major promotion in the world. Fighters at this point in the UFC should go in with a game plan on getting their one free eye poke and one free nut shot. Like just say, okay, when are we deciding to do the eye poke? Yeah. Round two, we'll start out with a nut shot. We'll do the eye poke in the first round, and then we'll finish him in the third round. Because, like, these guys don't get, I mean, they just, it seems like every ref just assumes that the first one, no matter how irresponsible, the first one's free. The first one's the one. At best, I mean, I've seen past where the first was accidental, the second was a warning, and then the third is a point deduction. By that point, the other guy doesn't even have an eye in his socket, right? Already has a ruptured testicle at some point. Like, that's part of it also.
I think this falls under, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. Yeah, this absolutely falls under that. I mean, if you're going to be given a free cheat on a test every single time you take a test, to pull out your phone. Teacher's not going to suspend you. The ref's not going to disqualify you. Fucking kick him in the, get your shot.
The funny part, James, last week, a fighter was disqualified for biting.
I saw that. Yeah, I actually saw that.
Right, and he ended up actually getting kicked out of the UFC. He got a guy. That was his first fight. Like his contract, seems like a lot. Right. But the thing is that the referee didn't even catch the bite. If it wasn't for the huge mark on his arm, it wouldn't have been a DQ. Right. And some people last week said, since it doesn't affect it wouldn't naturally affect the other fighter's ability to fight, that should have just been a point deduction and not a DQ.
How do you feel about it?
I mean, to me, with anything, if it's applied consistently, I'm fine, as long as it's consistent. Like, that's like we see in soccer with VAR, there are tons of offside calls now that didn't used to be offside calls because they were so close that the ref just let it go because it's like it's too quick for you to determine that the guy's toe, like literally the nose, the tip of his nose is offside at the moment the pass was like, but now they have technology to take care of all of that.
Right.
So a lot of people complain about VAR because it's like, come on, this is getting stupid. Yeah. But at least it's strictly applied to everything, right? Yeah. So it's like, fine. If you want to strictly, if you want to take it away and just be at the mercy of the referees, I'm fine with that. Just as long as it's consistent on a game-to-game basis, the strike zone is consistent on a game-to-game basis. Like that, what else can you ask for other than consistency? Because even when I umpired baseball, the number one complaint from managers was consistency. I mean, it's obviously they're a little bit biased towards their own team, but if I'm calling the outside part of the plate a little liberally, they at least want the outside part of the plate for their pitcher if I'm going to call it on their batters, right? If the pitcher knows that I'm not giving him the inside high part of the zone, right? Because it's very, especially at the higher levels, that's very hard to hit.
Yeah.
Like he knows not to throw it there. He's like, he's not going to try. But if I'm applying it for every so often, then they start getting pissed off because at least they can adjust and go, okay, this ump isn't giving me the inside part of the plate. Right. And then knows not to throw there. So it's like, okay, that's fine because it's consistent. It's when it's not consistent. That's like I said with the MMA, when the Weidman thing went to a replay and they changed. I mean, it didn't matter to me. Right.
Right.
But for DFS purposes, it instead of a third round finish, it became a decision. So that's 15 point difference. Like the Ruzabowa fight, he scored like 107 points.
Yeah.
If the same thing applied there, it should have been a no contest because they can't go to scorecards in the first round. So it's like just apply consistently. That's why I said after the Ruzabowa fight, I'm like, oh, if they just basically said rep didn't see it, sorry. You know, TKO stands in the third round, I would have been fine. I've been like, okay, maybe I don't agree with it, but at least two fights in a row, it was applied the same. Yeah. When it's not applied the same, that you just sit there and go, why even bother having a rule book?
Well, I mean, we see that all the time with MMA. It's the reason why I don't build projections for it. It's just like that the inconsistency, not only in the rules, but also in like the strike counting and stuff like that, is just, I can't feel good about modeling for it. The only way to model for it at this point is just to build off of the betting lines, which is, I know, is what you do. And like, it's just hard to do. That the inconsistencies are super frustrating. It's one of the reasons why I love baseball so much, is because we have so much data that even if there are some inconsistencies, you can pretty easily just kick them out of the data set. NFL, that's why.
Well, by the way, James, it's been 4 days into MLB. I know you're the king of short, small sample sizes when it comes to modeling. Is there anything specific you see out of the first 4 days that is noticeable?
I was doing some regression stuff this morning. There's nothing that we can take yet. But look for like Aaron Nola, who got just crushed in that first game. He was wildly unlucky. So is Luis Severino. Let's see.
But I mean, do you see anything with the ball? Like typically the narrative in the beginning of the season is, I don't know what type of balls they're using.
Oh, like, is there anything that stands out from that perspective? No, not yet. I mean, we'll usually see stuff like that about 2 weeks in, and then we'll be able to track a little bit more. There are some people that do a little bit better. I don't want to call it better, but deeper research on like ball tracking and stuff like that. And I usually defer to them when they start doing that kind of research on what kind of ball. But I will say that offense has been up for this time of year, over the first couple of games. So typically what we end up seeing is pretty depressed offense in the first month-ish, where we see ballparks that are typically not hitter friendly end up being good hitters parks because the ball's not traveling as far. But it's warmer than typical for the season. So across the league, we're seeing higher temperatures, we're seeing higher humidity. And that's leading to a little bit better offense. Mix that in with the pitchers not being fully stretched out and not being able to account yet for the ball being a little bit more generous towards hitters. And we are seeing offense up a little bit. So I don't think that's like super actionable. I think that you're still just stacking it up, right? But I do think you have to be a little bit more reticent of these like cheapy, shaky pitchers that might get punished later in the season. I think they'll be punished worse earlier in the season now too.
Well, I've been doing good so far the first three, four days. Good. of props. I so far, I 9 home run props. I hit 5 out of 9. which is obviously unsustainable. That's unsustainable. I got four today. I used the bat as a primary projection tool. So like if you want to sign up for the bat, feel free to do that. rotogrinders.com/thebat. If you want a little freebie today, I got four home run props today. So typically I feel like Grant. I feel like Grant's turd bombs type of thing.
But
at least to just give you a glimpse. Of course, the other day I was on the Grinders Live and I gave out Wilson Contreras.
Yeah.
And I had four home run props that day. He was the only one that didn't hit.
Yeah, of course.
I had four and I'm like, okay, here's Wilson Contreras. Also, because by the time those shows typically go on, the numbers move. Right.
Yeah.
So it's not like I also like that day I said I had Mookie Betts, but the numbers moved too much that I don't consider it a value anymore. And of course he hit a home run. So like, but I got it at like +450 instead of +360 or whatever the value was. Whatever the price was. So right now on the board that's still available. One may have moved, I don't know. Okay, so I got both in the Astros game, Altuve. Right now, the best line is +475 on DraftKings. I also have Chaz McCormick, and the best line is on FanDuel at +630.
Word.
And then I got Ryan Mountcastle. He's +750 on DraftKings. And then if you could get it, I don't know if it's still there, Bobby Witt is +800 on MGM. At least I got it at +800. It may have moved by then. So those are my four for today. As of right now, I don't typically the numbers move again. You know, the numbers don't move against me, but typically value doesn't typically show up later. All the home run props typically just get worse at once because people like betting the overs on home runs.
Yeah.
You know what I do, James? Now, I've obviously very small sample size. Bet365. Now DraftKings has these also, but Bet365 almost always has the better number. I've been betting like round robin home run unders.
Interesting.
Because FanDuel doesn't offer unders on home runs.
Yeah.
So what I do is I go to Bet365 and I take like all the home run unders that have 5% or more edge. And I just put them all together and just like round robin, like double, because they're all like, I mean, like dude, Jorge Polanco -425. Right.
Yeah.
You get like Ildemaro Vargas -1200. Like, right. What am I doing? Well, I mean, what am I going to bet $25 on that for 50 cents? I mean, like, right. It just seems stupid. So, but if you put the -1200 with Aaron Judge's -220,
right,
then it becomes kind of, so yesterday, I think I had like 12 of them in a round robin two pick. Right. So, and I put like $10 or something for the whole thing. It costs like, ends up costing like $400, but it's like 70 different bets. I mean, it's all these different bets. And like yesterday, 12 of them, one was a void because he didn't play. He didn't start. And then I got all 11 right.
Oh, yeah.
So it's just like done, right?
Yeah, I mean, the no on home run props is super powerful. And people never take it because they don't want to take minus odds on things like that. But like, the chances of people hitting home runs are considerably lower than you think that they actually are. Like, considerably lower than you actually think they are. The best chance that I have for anyone to hit a home run today is Aaron Judge at 44%. 44%.
So I mean, you have him at 44%. Let me bring this up. Where did that go? No, I mean, I'm not going to put it on the... Oh, okay. My whole thing is fucked up. So 44% is what? What odds?
Was that like +135?
Yeah, like something like that.
Ish.
I was gonna bring up. So you have it at 44%?
Yeah.
+127. Yeah, something around there. plus 127. I mean, look, the best line available. So you're on his over then.
Yeah, I would be on his over. I would be on his over plus and Kyle Schwarber.
The bat has him at like way lower than that, like 34%.
Yeah, I believe that.
Or even less.
Those two are the big deviations for me, Aaron Judge and Kyle Schwarber. And then after that, everything drops into like the low 30s.
Right. Now, the thing is that the bat still has Aaron Judge as the most likely player to hit a home run. Like, is the highest home run. He has the highest home run projection. It's just that it's not better than the odds. I mean, typically, right. if home run props that are like worse than plus 200 are typically, you're not betting plus one. DraftKings has Aaron Judge at plus 170 to hit home run. Like, yeah, which in a cool. general rule, you're not going to be taking home run props like that.
No, I have not hit my home run props today. But the ones that I'm just looking at projections now. Cal Raleigh looks really good.
I have the opposite of that.
What do you have on Cal Raleigh? What's his line?
His line is plus 390 on FanDuel. That's the best line currently.
I'd probably take plus 390.
Take plus 390. I have his under at minus 425. I do have his.
I don't want to trade you 30 cents on that, but I think he's a decent shot. But I don't usually take a whole bunch of home run props, so maybe I'm bad.
Well, I don't take a ton. I mean, I only take the ones that show up. I compare the bat. I look at the number, and it's very hard to find good ones on FanDuel because it's not a two-way market, but sometimes you can.
Yeah,
I mean, some of these are laughably negative EV. Like Michael Bush on FanDuel is plus 630.
That's hilarious.
Are you kidding me? Plus 630.
Well, and that's the problem with home run props too. Is there's a sweet spot between like 350 and 600, and you have to attack that range because anybody worse than 600, you're right. getting hung over a barrel and not getting anything you need.
Here's another funny one, James. I have one that shows as a negative 78% edge.
That's hilarious. Which one is that?
Negative compared to the bat. It's a plus 1200 on Stephen Kwan.
Yeah, that's pretty
like
bad.
Like people look at plus 1200 and go 12-1. It's like, no, you should be getting like 40-1 on Stephen Kwan. Yeah. 50. That dude hits like one or two home runs a year.
I was gonna say, yeah, he hits like max 5 home runs a year. The guy is choked up so far in the bat, he's holding the front. Like he's not hitting home runs.
What are some other funny ones of FanDuel? Yeah, a lot of the Cubs ones. Apparently the bat is under on the Cubs today. So if you're playing DFS, I don't know if that's on the early slate. Is that on the that's on the early slate. If you're playing the Cubs. I don't know. The bat's under on the Cubs. Bat's also been under on Seattle early in the season.
Yeah.
Under on Boston. Just what from what I've noticed. I mean, this is what, 4 days worth of stuff. Also, James, another question about early season baseball. How are you handling the pitch counts? Especially when it comes to the second start.
Yeah, so it's kind of touch and go on that. That's the most manual part of my research. I have a lot of different algorithmic parts that like building out baselines, everything like that. But when it comes to pitch counts, I really do have to go in and take a look and see how long they're going. See, are they still ramping up? Like how many spring training outings did they have? Like were they dealing with an injury? I mean, Kevin Gausman, for instance, in his first start, people made a mistake with starting him. And I was like, he has like a 4-5 innings pitch max limit here because he's coming off of injury, right? But he's still priced people saw him priced up where he was last year and assumed that he was fine.
He still went over his K prop though. That killed that crushed.
Because he's a monster. Because he's good. I get it. But like
five and a half. How does he go over 5.5 at his pitch count? Whatever. I still had a good day yesterday, but or the day whatever.
But you're a little mad about
under 5.5.
Sure.
I'm mad that the pitch count was correct and he still was just too efficient, right? Okay. That right, because that sometimes you get that. Sometimes it's like, yeah, he only pitches 83 pitches, right? Yeah. And you know, whatever Chris, I mean, I had the Chris Sale over. A lot of people complained about that. It's like, oh, Chris Sale is not gonna pitch more than 85 pitches. Like this dude could get 12 strikeouts in 85 pitches.
Yeah, right? For sure.
Rejection over 5.5 is like giving to me, or 4.5, whatever the hell it was. I had the over on that.
But to answer that, it's just like a lot of it just has to do on how much research I can do. Because I go through every single pitcher. The first probably, I want to say the first 2 weeks is the most like labor intensive part of my MLB projection process. Because I have to go through every single pitcher every single day and look over their pitch counts, look over their workload, look over any injuries that might have happened, all of that different kind of stuff. I do it for every single pitcher. So,
James, just for today's sake, what do you have? I think the two pitchers that – what do you have Luis Gill and what do you have Max Meyer at?
Yeah, so Luis Gill, he's by far the highest projection for me right now because I have him at 6 innings pitched.
But you do innings? You don't do, like, pitches thrown?
No. Because I think that breaking it down to pitches thrown, like, while I think that there is some value to that, I think that – trying like with the way that the baseball model works, it goes off of innings pitched as a baseline, and then it will go through the process of iterating through different pitches and different outcomes.
Okay.
So the way that I do it is
so kind you have of, Luis Gill for 6 innings. I'm just want to let you know that Cardi has him at 71 pitch count.
Yeah, I have him. My look at him had him at around 5 to 6 innings pitched. I may drop it, and I'm considering dropping it a bit.
Okay. How about Max Meyer? What do you got his innings pitch?
I think I have him at 5.
Okay. I mean,
I have him lower because his spring training just didn't inspire a lot of confidence. And to be fair, neither does Luis Gill, right? He only had 17 batters faced in that final inning, but he did have 5 total sessions in spring training, which is nice. That's more than a large handful of guys. I think that especially early in the season, I err onto the side of caution and say 5 innings pitched as a baseline for most guys. And that's typically where I'll sit, except for like the aces. You know, Strider's going to go 6. Burns is going to go 6. You know, those guys are going to go the distance. But a lot of the guys, I'll just default to 5 innings pitched. And then say that there was a guy in spring training who only worked up to like 3.2 innings pitched, like didn't even hit 4 innings pitch. And only had like 3, maybe 4 sessions. Speaking specifically to Freddie Peralta, he's gonna be 4 to 5, right? Like I wouldn't be surprised if he drops below that 5 innings pitch threshold. And then in his second start, I still might not even give him 6, depending on how deep he went. So it's mostly just trying to track that ramp up progress. Guys usually don't hit their full workload until their 7th or 8th instance. So in spring training, if they get 5, if they get 6, that's awesome. They can work all the way up to their full workload by the first or the second outing in the regular season. But if you see guys only getting 3, 4 spring training starts and they don't even pass 4 innings pitched in spring training, like they're not going to have a 6 innings pitch baseline until their 3rd or 4th time through the rotation.
What do you have Shota Imanaga today?
I have him at 6. I think he goes 4.
Okay.
Because of his pedigree.
So I have his K over.
What's his K over at right now?
5.5.
5.5. I'm gonna be under on him because I don't work too hard to like track through between leagues. Yeah, I have him at 5. It's right there. I probably wouldn't have taken either side, but I think over 5.5 is fine.
Because Cardi has him high and he has him with the highest raw K projection on the
yeah game. Well, and he'll have a leash too. That's kind of the good thing about these guys who come over from the Asian leagues. Like these guys have leashes; they can go forever. which is great. We love that for DFS and we love that for prop betting because we don't really have to worry that much about leashes. Whereas guys like, yeah, Max Meyer, I don't know, between five and six innings pitch makes sense, but he could drop all the way down to four, and those kind of annoyances are hard to bet on.
Right. We have a lot of them on this slide. We have guys like Jay Silseth and Ryne Nelson. Like Ryne Nelson, like, I mean, Dane Dunning is a little bit more of a like this. Well, I mean, because we're getting into the parts of the rotation where.
Right.
I mean, for some teams, the parts of the rotation are the first guy anyway, so it doesn't even matter. Right.
Right.
Right. Like, not many people have a great pitching staff. But yeah. I mean, there's a lot of candidates on the slate for maybe only go 65 pitches because.
Yeah.
Not very good, right?
Yeah, the guy like that I have Bowden, with the
Fran, like Bowden Francis and Keaton Wynn. I mean, not everyone could be Charlie Morton, right? Not everyone could be Michael Wacha. You know, guys like, you know, just like Mackenzie Gore. I mean, no, he typically doesn't go all that long.
Yeah, a lot but of I these mean, guys like, should probably pencil in for less than 18 outs. I have them all. Between 15 and 18, the lowest that I have is Keaton Wynn at about 16.8.
Right.
And I just
I'd
think
be interested.
Yeah, go for it.
No, I'd be interested, James, if you want to take on a little bit of a project.
Mm-hmm.
For pitcher out props,
yeah.
The most important part of pitcher out props is between 15 and 18 outs.
Yeah.
If you could analyze past data and even on as a baseline, I've kind of looked at this, but I've done it in a very, very rudimentary way.
Yeah.
How often does a pitcher who starts the sixth inning finish the sixth inning?
Right. Yeah.
Because pitcher outs are not all created equal. And the most valuable pitching outs are the 16th, 17th, and 18th out.
Right.
Like if you're taking, you know, over 16 and a half, that may be virtually the same as taking over 17 and a half.
Right.
Right. If you're taking over 15 and a half, that may be functionally about the same as taking over 17 and a half. Only because many of the times, more often than not, a pitcher is going to, if they start the inning, is going to finish the inning. Unless they're significantly up in their pitch count or they get into trouble. Or that they're facing a platoon situation where, you know, oh, the big lefty is coming up and he's right at the cusp of his pitch count. And we're going to put in the lefty reliever in. To me, even knowing like how valuable those pitching outs are, because I tend to just avoid those spots. It's very rare that I'm taking 16 and a halfs and 17 and a halfs without pricing them as if they're like, to me, 15 and a half is the same as 16 and a half, which is the same as 17 and a half.
Right.
So it's like, if I'm not willing to take this over 17 and a half, I'm not willing to take the over 15 and a half. Right. And same for the unders. Like if under 17 and a half, if I'm not willing to take under 15 and a half, I'm not willing to take under 17 and a half. Right. Like the 18 and a half and the 14, you know, we rarely see 14 and a half, but like those I could do on their own. But the thing is that maybe I'm missing profitable situations where the two outs, the one out, the two out actually do make that big of a difference depending on how often these pitchers actually pitch to the end of the inning.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's probably something there. And I think that the two things off the top of my head that would probably be most correlative would be the strength of the opposing top of the order. That's typically what you run into depending on, you know, it's not always, depends on walks and hits and stuff like that. It's not always, but based on the sequential drop of the order, you'll typically run into the top of the order in the sixth, which is why guys usually get pulled. And then how good the pitcher is at dealing with those situations, because there are a lot of pitchers. It's hard to attack it actionably, but there are a lot of pitchers that do legitimately struggle with that third time through the order. They just end up falling apart. One guy that I can think of just off the top of my head would be Jose Berrios has been somebody who in the past has shown that like he can fall apart third time through the order. So I think there's probably something there. And I think that when it comes to especially things that are typically condensed in the outcomes that are allowed. So things where you're looking at, oh, a sports book basically always offers 15 and a half, 16 and a half, 17 and a half, stuff like that. It's kind of the same thing in my mind as sports books always offering the same spread between teams of 1.5 points for baseball. Right. That is very, very actionable in terms of something that you can attack based on the correlation between a winning percentage and a spread and stuff like that. Like you can attack those things algorithmically. Because we know historically how large the spread typically is between teams based on their money line and stuff like that. So, yeah, there's probably something there. It just depends on what things are correlative to it and if those things would be consistent.
So we'll be talking baseball for at one point. I know it's April 1st,
yeah,
4 days into the baseball season.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a prediction? Post it in the comments if you want. Obviously, hit that like button.
I know where this is going.
At what point, what should be the over-under on the date in which we first complain about when is baseball going to end? When are we getting NFL back? When are you getting sick of baseball? Like that type of commentary. What should the date be over-under?
We usually make it a long time in baseball because you and I both really like MLB DFS and really like prop betting in baseball. Yeah. But man, once the chalk just starts dominating in the summer, grind gets a little bit harder.
If the chalk's dominating, that means I'm probably doing very well in props.
In props, yeah. Yeah. So you,
because
you
the chalk longer. Tends to correlate with the projections. So, yeah.
You last longer than I do.
Right.
You last longer than I do.
Okay. Would you put the over under at the All-Star game? Or should it be even before that?
It'll probably be a little bit before that. I was
contemplating that maybe it should be like third week of July. You're saying maybe it should be the third week of June.
Yeah, like late June, early July, maybe. But it depends, you know. If I have two live final seats this year instead of just one, then maybe I don't complain at all.
Well, you've got to factor that into the line. We have to. We're trying to odds make here. We're trying to.
Right. Yeah. We have to factor in. How much
are you that confident in that you'll
how much better did James get at MLB DFS over the offseason? And if he got good enough to get another ticket, then you know maybe we have to put this back towards the All-Star break.
If you tell me June 21st is the over under, I'm going to take the over. So like. So maybe that isn't the best line because I think the edge is
on July 4th. Let's say July 4th. That's my over-under.
July 4th. Early July. That's not the All-Star break yet. That's a week before the All-Star break.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying. July 4th.
Okay, so July 4th. I'm still taking the over.
Still taking the over. All right. Love that. And I hope you are right. I hope that you're right, that we make it past
the All-Star break. Are you taking the under?
I don't know, man.
If you take the under, obviously you could – obviously, you could, you know,
I could hedge.
Dante Porter this thing up, right? You could just say that, yeah. You know, I'm not feeling very good and I wish MLB would be over. You could do that tomorrow and be like, okay, I win.
No, I'm hoping it's a really good season. Hoping that improvements that I made, like there's some really cool stuff that I'm able to do. That the other day, so I'm reworking some of the contest sims logic. Contest sims aren't available yet for pay dirt for baseball because I am putting my machine to full use. The other day, I guess how long it took me to run 200 million lineups. 200 million.
3 seconds.
7 seconds. But
okay. I know you could run a million in less than a second. So like, yeah. I just
200 and I should say 200 million. And I had to parallelize that against three different times. So technically it was 600 million in 7 seconds. So that feels really cool. And I'm doing some things to, really make contest sims a lot more useful in short periods of time. Right now they take a little too long to run. So I'm trying to make them run considerably faster. And once that's done, I think that baseball is going to be kind of like really, really, that's going to be like the start of baseball season for me. So I'm really excited for that, even though I stick by what I said with contest sims the other day. And I don't think they're going to be as valuable for baseball, but I think that having the tech available for them will still make me feel better about the baseball season.
Well, I know that our producer, Steve, he used SimLabs for MLB. Or whatever. I mean, he used SimLabs and he presses the button. He looks and goes, picks one of the top lineups. And I think he won a GPP the other day, like by 27 points by just like, wow, I don't even know anything. And just click around. That's, I mean, I use SimLabs. I use SimLabs for MLB in conjunction with the bat.
Yeah.
It's not bad projects. Basically, I'm using SimLabs, getting a whole stock full of lineups, a lot of times way more than 150. And then I'm using the bat projections to weed out the lineups.
Right.
That, right? Because I use SimLabs, right? So I'm using SimLabs. I may build 600 lineups in SimLabs, right? If I have time, right? 600 lineups. Then I go through those 600 lineups in SimLabs. Get rid of like the high bet, like anything that I don't want. And maybe out of 600, I get down to 100.
Yeah.
And then I take out the 100 and then I move it into lineup HQ, which you could do easily on Roto Grinders. And then I have the bat projections there and I cut out basically the bottom end of the bat project. Cause I don't use the projection slider in SimLabs because I'm going to be using the bat projection. Right. So doesn't matter to me. So out of the 100, maybe I take the top 50. Then I take the top 50, I take it and put it into the Theory DFS portfolio trimmer.
Yep.
And compare the ownerships. And then I eliminate that down. And I usually get down to about 20.
Yep.
From there. And I'm other than diversity purposes, I'm essentially done.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Says on Saturday's the main slate, I used the RG SimLabs beta and finished fifth in the 222 25 entry max GPP on FanDuel. Well, good.
That rules. That's awesome. Yeah. I keep saying that I don't think the contest sims will be as valuable. That doesn't mean that I think that they are pointless. I think they're awesome. But I think they're more awesome, even more powerful for things like NBA and Showdown. And that's basically where I've landed. It's from all the research that I've done on it. NBA and Showdown, that's where you're going to get the max value out of things like contest sims. And then things like baseball and NHL, that's where you're going to get the least. But that's saying that, like, it's the difference between, like, 100% capacity and, like, 80% capacity, right? Like, it's still a really, really cool piece of tech.
Ryan, have you used that in conjunction with Theory DFS for advanced players with the custom Excel tools? It's a 10-chapter audio course, so you can develop a systematic, repeatable, time-efficient process to analyze slates effectively and consistently build lineups that show a long-term profit. So go check that out. Me and James did it. Theoryofdfs.com. James is at paydirt_DFS on Twitter. Hit that thumbs up button on your way out the door. We got Grinders Live later today. We got Crunch Time. We got NBA. We got NHL. We got MLB. Sign up for Roto Grinders. Click on the link in the description. 6-month subscription. You get $250 off. So join us. They use the trial pass, $19.99 for the 3 days. Use everything that you can here. It's the same. This is the stuff that I use, right? Yep. So if you want to bet on props, I'm using the bat projections, which are available here on Roto Grinders. So go ahead. Join me. It'll be my luck, James, that the 4 home run props, that I don't hit any of them. It's like, what? But you were 5 for nine. Yeah, I mean, it's not like, dude. If I could hit like 20% of my home run props, That's wildly profitable.
I was going to say, if you miss the next 11 after going 5 for 9, then you're still overachieving. You're still overachieving.
Okay. So see you tomorrow. I believe we'll be talking hockey tomorrow. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe Tim or Taylor. Someone's going to be on tomorrow. We always got baseball. So essentially, unless you have questions about NBA, probably not going to talk much about NBA much anymore. But it'll be Tuesdays and Thursdays, NHL / MLB, Wednesday, mostly MLB, Fridays, MMA. And obviously, when we have early slates, if we have decent early slates, I'll just be on Grinders Live instead of this show. And if it's a small early slate that there's no Grinders Live, we may even do some live, you know, contest builds and lineup builds. Just on the, I will literally build my lineups in Sim Labs and Lineup HQ for, you know, some 4 or 5 game early slate. So tune in for all of that. And I'm always here Monday through Friday, 11 o'clock Eastern, talking about all things you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. Daily fantasy props and pick 'em on Roto Grinders today.